You're listening to LawPod UK. It's a podcast brought to you by the barristers of One Crown Office Row, and it covers all aspects of civil and public law in the United Kingdom. All comments are current at time of publication, and this episode is presented by me, Rosalind English. Hello, LawPod listeners. In this episode, we'll be talking about gambling addiction and, sadly, gambling-related deaths and inquests. If you develop an addiction to meth or cocaine, or if you're an alcoholic, people will notice. But with gambling, people don't know if you're doing it, let alone whether you're in way too deep. You can lose so much money that you may end up losing your house before anyone notices. And the consequences get worse, sometimes ending up in suicide. I have two experts in this area to discuss this problem with me, Mary Varney and Dan Webster from the solicitors firm Lee Day. Mary Varney is a partner in the Human Rights Department and head of the Lee Day Inquest Group. She regularly represents bereaved families in inquests. Dan Webster is an associate solicitor in the Human Rights Department, working as part of Mary Varney's team. Dan also represents bereaved families at inquests, acts for claimants and negligence claims, and represents clients in judicial review proceedings or in applications for an inquest to be held under Section 13 of the Coroner's Act 1988. Dan has been involved in a number of inquests involving concerns over gambling harms, including the actions of gambling operators and wider issues regarding the information available about risks associated with gambling and treatment available for gambling disorder and gambling regulation. Gambling harm is an ever-growing problem and has little coverage in the press, even though it remains high on the political agenda. It's also changed almost beyond recognition in the 2 decades since the Gambling Act came into force in 2005. A casino can be accessed from your pocket 24/7, and the UK betting and gambling industry is booming, generating profits in excess of £15 million in 2023 alone. So maybe, Dan, can we start with you for an assessment of the scale of this problem? What, for example, do people bet on?
Well, there are a very large range of things that people bet on, and I think it's ever growing because smartphones and gambling platforms are becoming more and more accessible and allowing people to bet on high-speed events within sports, within football matches, betting on sort of micro-events in play that generate results and responses, outcomes of bets very, very quickly in a way that's recognised to be more addictive, and emulating perhaps casino products like online slots games, which are recognised as being among the most addictive products, partly due to their speed. So I think the key changes that have perhaps occurred over the last sort of couple of decades in gambling arise from sort of technological advances and the increased availability of casinos in people's pockets and these sort of increasingly high-speed games that are becoming more and more omnipresent and easily accessible to so many people.
And I think I read somewhere, was it in the Public Health England's recent gambling harms evidence review, they estimated that there is more than one suicide related to gambling every day in England alone. Does that ring true?
Well, there are a number of different estimates that have been put forward publicly for numbers of suicides per year. They are somewhat contentious, but I think it is right to say that the best estimates that are available indicate that the sort of number of suicides per year in England alone are in the hundreds. And certainly, I think it's reflected in the work that we do and what we've seen through our work that this is a large-scale problem, that this is not just a case of, you know, an isolated few instances of people sadly taking their own life due to gambling addiction. This is a significant and wide-scale public health issue.
So I think this really brings us on to the inquest that you have both been involved with. Perhaps, Mary, you'd like to take this up. Can you talk us through both what triggers an inquest and what kind of inquest is held when there's a gambling-related death?
Absolutely. So inquests are held wherever there is a death that is due to an unnatural cause and a death that is believed to be due to suicide will always require an investigation by a coroner and an inquest hearing. And the purpose of that inquest is to answer four questions: who died, where they died, when they died, and how they came by their death. And one of the really thorny legal issues here is that when a coroner is investigating how somebody came by their death, whether or not the coroner will look where they're considering that the death appears to be through suicide at whether or not gambling played a role, a contribution in why that person and how that person came by their death. Some coroners are very reluctant to look at it. And the work that we've been doing is on behalf of bereaved families who feel very strongly that the public record should reflect the role of gambling as being the cause of their loved one's death.
Okay, so just so we have a clearer picture of the kind of inquests, I mean, from my understanding, I'm not an expert in this myself, that there are basically two different kinds of inquests. There's the Jameson inquest, and then there's the Middleton Article 2 inquest. Would one of you like to expand on that?
The key difference between a Jameson and a Middleton type inquest, as they're colloquially known by lawyers, is whether or not Article 2, the right to life, Article 2 of the European Convention on Human Rights, incorporated by the Human Rights Act, is applicable, engaged in the inquest. Is the coroner of the view that there was an arguable breach of the substantive Article 2 duties such that the inquest must comply with the investigative Article 2 duty? And what that means is that the coroner's obligation is not just to answer the four questions: who, when, where, and how. It turns how into how and in what circumstances. So at the end of the inquest, the coroner or the jury have to reach a conclusion that addresses those broader circumstances. They are also allowed to use critical language in a way that is not permitted in a non-Article 2 inquest. It used to be the case that many would say the difference between an Article 2 and a non-Article 2 inquest was quite a large one. More recently, it is very much the case that the difference comes at the conclusion of the inquest and not necessarily the scope and the issues that are investigated. And the majority of inquests that we've been instructed in that relate to gambling-related harms, the coroner has not found that Article 2 is engaged.
We'll have a look at these wider, more investigative inquests perhaps first, particularly when it culminates in a prevention of future deaths report. Would either of you, again, Mary or Dan, like to talk about the inquest into Jack Ritchie's death? The inquest concluded in 2022.
Jack died in Vietnam, and the inquest that took place here looked at whether or not there was an adequate system of regulation of gambling and awareness of gambling-related harms. And in that inquest, the coroner did find that Article 2 was engaged, and he required government bodies to attend as interested persons in the inquest. And the inquest concluded that failures in regulation and awareness of gambling-related harms had caused Jack's death. The inquest heard evidence from a wide range of experts, as well as from Jack's parents and Jack's GP, and it really highlighted the breadth of issues related to gambling-related harm, from a lack of awareness amongst medical professionals, a lack of services, a lack of regulation that was fit for purpose. And as far as we know, it was one of the first inquests to properly investigate the role of gambling in that way in the death of a young man.
And there was a report, wasn't there, what's known as Prevention of Future Deaths report. What did the coroner broadly say in that?
The coroner wrote a Prevention of Future Death report on the basis that he felt that the evidence had shown there was still a risk to future lives, and he called on government departments to address the inadequate regulatory framework that was in place and for more to be done to raise training and awareness, especially amongst medical professionals, around gambling-related harm. It is not something that had been routinely asked about at all. You know, and parents know about the risks of smoking, alcohol, illicit drugs, and they speak to their children about it. Doctors routinely ask about it. Gambling is not treated like that. And these issues were exposed due to the strength and tenacity of Jack's family and the willingness of the coroner. And it was those concerns that were then set out in the Prevention of Future Death report to the government department, who had the ability to take steps to address these harms.
So, Dan, do you wish that the Ritchie inquest and the broader powers of the coroner had formed a sort of template for future inquests in this area?
Well, certainly it would be helpful in a number of ways, I think, to have more certainty in an ability for us to advise bereaved families with a bit more confidence about the approach that coroners are likely to take across the board. It remains very uncertain, and the lack of any sort of precedent effect and the lack of any sort of perhaps clear guidance about the investigation of concerns of this nature by coroners means that it remains a real lottery for bereaved families, and it's very difficult for us to advise them with any confidence, you know, even on the same facts. The extent to which a coroner is likely to investigate their concerns will vary quite significantly across, you know, different areas and different coroners. And yeah, that's certainly been reflected in our experience of the gambling-related inquest that we've been involved in. And yeah, it's an issue that we feel quite strongly creates a lot of unfairness for bereaved families and, yeah, a lot more uncertainty in the process for them. But I think the Ritchie inquest has had a significant impact in terms of educating coroners and the public more widely about gambling harm and gambling-related suicide. And fortunately, it has been followed by other inquests in which coroners have been willing to investigate families' concerns about these issues and outcomes which have reflected the contribution of gambling to death in a number of cases that I think we'll come on to speak about.
In my reading of these inquests and the reports, there's reference to various types of treatment available on the NHS and private charities and so on. This is interesting because gambling is a non-substance related addiction. Mary, do you want to comment on that?
Yes, and it was new to me when I was first instructed in this area. Gambling addiction, gambling disorder is a recognised mental health condition, and it is the only addiction that is recognised in that way that is not related to a substance that the body is exposed to, be it alcohol, tobacco, drugs, and so forth. And there are talks that other areas may be found. I mean, there have been litigation, obviously, in America in relation to social media that have been based around the products being addictive. But to date, gambling disorder, gambling addiction is the only recognised mental health condition. And up until very recently, there was very limited NHS-provided treatment, and it wasn't seen as a sort of public health issue. A lot of that has come about because of people like the families of Jack Ritchie and the way that they have campaigned and ensured that the inquest, as we discussed earlier, investigated as widely as possible the role of gambling in their son's death.
I read somewhere, this may be true or not true, but it certainly struck a chord, that gambling addiction, unlike other behavioural addictions, you know, shopping addiction, sex addiction, actually changes the chemistry of the brain in the way that substance abuse does. So there really should be a very effective health interventions available to people who are in trouble.
Yes, and yet gambling is advertised routinely across the TV on football shirts that people wear who children worship. the more you understand about gambling related harm, the more everywhere you look, all you see is gambling adverts. And it is frankly eye-watering that there is something that is now known to produce the same level of harm as some banned or heavily controlled substances remains as rampant and accepted in society and with our political classes, often very in bed with them, not literally.
Do you think then that the regulator, the Gambling Commission, under the Gambling Act, is effectively powerless? I mean, it does have prosecutorial and investigative powers. Do they not carry it out enough or not widely?
I think there's a few different issues with the Gambling Commission. Part of the issue is definitely in the actual legislation, the Gambling Act 2005, being legislation that is no longer really fit for purpose in the modern age. It was really out of date at the time it was introduced, because by the time it actually came into force, the iPhone had recently been released and the availability of casinos in people's pockets boomed very quickly, and the Gambling Act simply wasn't designed to deal with that boom and the availability of online gambling. So there is a need for legislative change to ensure that there's more meaningful and forceful regulation of the industry in a way that keeps up with technological advances. But I think there are also issues culturally with the Gambling Commission. You know, a lot of the people that we work with, bereaved families we work with, have, I think, legitimate concerns about the proximity of the Gambling Commission's relationship with the industry and the way in which they regulate largely behind closed doors in a way that is severely lacking in transparency. And yeah, although the text of the sort of license conditions and codes of practice and guidance that are issued by the Gambling Commission to operators can often read as being, you know, quite sensible, the way in which that's actually enforced in practice and the penalties that operators face for breaching those conditions is, I think, broadly inadequate and certainly doesn't reflect the scale on which harm is being caused to people, including to bereaved families who, you know, we've worked with them in trying to sort of bring complaints to the Gambling Commission and to seek investigation of their concerns about their loved ones gambling. And the responses they've met from the Commission have been extremely frustrating for those families due to a lack of transparency and a real sort of lack of any apparent rigour in investigating concerns that bereaved families feel strongly have contributed to someone's death.
Gambling is, of course, an important source of non-tax revenue for the government. And it's as old as the hills. The word addict apparently comes from, in Roman times, if you had to go to a loan shark in order to pay off your gambling debt, you were served an addictus, which in effect enslaved you to the loan shark. So there you go, we're dealing with a very old, very intractable problem, and one that clearly governments don't want to make go away because of the revenue source.
We are, but we also have a industry-led narrative that if you have a problem with gambling, if you suffer harm because of gambling, it's your fault. There's something inherently wrong with you. You haven't stopped when the fun stops. There is very little awareness amongst the general public of the extent to which gambling can cause rapid harm and fatal harm, and the extent it is doing that in society. And it's not necessarily about people being at the point of financial ruin. Debt may be a factor, but that is not what we have seen in relation to the bereaved families, their loved ones. There is a lot of evidence of disordered thinking, of compulsive behaviour, shame. It is not necessarily this picture that somebody's life is in total ruin in the sense of financial despair. It is that somebody is addicted to these products and they are causing enormous disruption and negative impact on their mental well-being. And hence, we see the numbers that we do so high of people suffering gambling-related suicides.
What other forms of legal action are available to you, to anybody, apart from asking for an Article 2 inquest when there has been gambling-related harm?
it doesn't necessarily need to be an Article 2 inquest. That's one forum for an investigation just through the inquest process. There are negligence claims, and Dan can talk more about the forthcoming civil trial that's about to take place on that front. There's no ombudsman. The Gambling Commission are not charged with investigating individual complaints. And as matters stand, the law is not great. It doesn't provide easy tools for redress. And, you know, we see lots of people who've tried to take complaints and so forth against operators and with very limited success. So, you know, I think that's one of the things that we'd like to see in future, the law providing better access to bereaved families and other victims of gambling-related harms. But in terms of negligence, Dan can talk about the case coming up.
Yes, Dan, do let us know.
Well, just to add briefly to what Mary was saying there, I think it's right that certainly in my view at the moment, there is a real lack of sort of meaningful redress for people who are harmed by gambling. And really, even in circumstances where, say, an operator seriously breaches the regulatory requirements and someone is able to show evidence that they not just lost serious amounts of money as a result of that, but also, you know, suffered significant psychological harm, there is a real lack of meaningful redress. They don't have the same rights as consumers, I think, in other areas who might have access to an ombudsman, other means of redress in the gambling sphere. As Mary mentioned, there is no ombudsman. The Gambling Commission's position is it doesn't investigate individual complaints, so it will just receive information from members of the public and consider whether that gives rise to a need for regulatory action. But even in those circumstances, if it does take regulatory action, it won't keep the individual who's actually made the complaint informed of that action. And they'll only ever find out if action's taken by means of any sort of public statement the Gambling Commission might make a couple of years down the line. So for someone who is in that position, it's extremely difficult. They can make a complaint to a gambling operator. There are then alternative dispute resolution providers who they're referred to try and escalate that complaint when it's inevitably turned away by the operator. Those alternative dispute resolution providers expressly say that they can't determine disputes about what's called problem gambling. So they can't deal with disputes relating to, you know, someone saying they've been harmed by gambling. So people are stuck in a sort of vicious cycle being signposted between these alternate dispute resolution providers, the Gambling Commission and operators, where there is simply no way of obtaining any sort of form of justice for their complaint, and they're left considering legal action such as a negligence claim as the only route of potentially obtaining compensation or recovering their losses. And that comes with its own very significant challenges, obviously significant costs and emotional burdens, legal challenges, the need for expert legal advice and representation in order to be able to bring a claim of that nature. And the legal position as things stand basically limits the circumstances in which a claim of that nature is viable. And, you know, we think there's a need for the legal position to be revisited and to reflect some of the developments that we've been talking about in terms of the sort of omnipresence of gambling in people's lives, the accessibility of highly addictive products through smartphones, and the extent of data that operators have about people and the fact that they use that data to target people with inducements and so on, but don't do an adequate job of using that data to identify harm and to intervene when appropriate. So, yeah, that's the general context. So the civil trial that's due to be heard in the High Court starting later this week is a claim arising from the death of Luke Ashton, who took his own life in April 2021. And we represent Luke's wife, Annie, and the couple's children. And we've represented them since the inquest proceedings into Luke's death. The inquest took place in 2023, and the coroner concluded at the inquest that Luke had a long-standing gambling disorder and that that was part of the medical cause of Luke's death. He also concluded that in the period leading up to Luke's death, when he was gambling at a very high level with the operator Betfair, there should have been greater steps taken by Betfair to interact with Luke and to intervene in his gambling. So that was the outcome of the inquest. Since then, Annie and the family have brought a civil claim against Betfair for compensation. And that claim is now listed for trial in the High Court. And the issues for the court to consider at that trial will essentially be whether Betfair owed a duty of care to Luke and if so, whether that duty of care was breached, and if so, whether any breaches of duty of care by Betfair caused Luke's death. And that involves, in part, revisiting a case of Calvert and William Hill, which was heard by the High Court and subsequently the Court of Appeal over 15 years ago now, which established that essentially a duty of care can be owed by gambling operators to customers. But on the facts of that case, it was decided that the scope of that duty was limited to individuals who make a request to be self-excluded, and where the operator then doesn't honour that request and fails to implement the self-exclusion. The thrust of the claimant's case here is that, in accordance with duty of care common law principles, a duty of care should be found to be owed by gambling operators where effectively there's constructive knowledge on the part of the operator that an individual is suffering harm as a result of their gambling, such as to require intervention. So that's one of the key issues that the court will be considering.
If you win that case, it sounds that would be a really important precedent for future actions against gambling operators.
Yeah, well, we certainly think it's overdue that the courts should consider this issue again in light of all the significant developments we've been talking about over the last 20 years or so in this area.
Yes.
And we sincerely hope that it will contribute to positive developments for future cases.
I want to ask you both, I mean, we've been talking about what would be good in this area, what could be changed and so on, but if either of you were able to implement just one reform, what would it be?
It's a very difficult question because of the number of different issues. In a sentence, I'd want to improve the law as a tool mechanism for gambling-related harm. But that needs multiple different actions. So I'm taking a get-out clause of giving just one. The duty of care being modernised, or the duty of care reflecting modern gambling, a regulator that is very in favour of protecting against the public health harms, improvements in awareness. There's too many to mention.
Dan, do you have your input there?
Yeah, I mean, Mary's certainly right to say that it's a very big question and there's a whole number of things that we could talk about for a very long time. But one that I feel quite strongly about is the issue about the lack of an ombudsman or the lack of any body that actually determines people's complaints about how they've been treated by gambling operators. Although we know from our experience in other sectors that an ombudsman isn't likely to be a sort of silver bullet cure for gambling harm, it's still, in my view, very important as a matter of fairness that there is at least somewhere that people can turn to when they've been wronged by an operator, and that offers a potential route to recovering gambling losses and so on. So I think it's very important that that's introduced. It was one of the reforms that was proposed in the gambling white paper back in 2023, which has largely been sitting on a shelf ever since, seemingly, and not been progressed by the Labour government. So certainly in my view, that's a really important reform that should be introduced.
Can I just add from an inquest lawyer's point of view an answer to that question? And that would be, whether it be through chief coroner guidance or other means, a requirement or acceptance by coroners that where a family have these concerns about gambling playing a role in their loved one's death, that they will be investigated, because for bereaved families who are asking us what the inquest process is going to look like, there is so much uncertainty at a time that they are already carrying and suffering so much, and it's so unnecessary. And if we are really going to understand the scale of this harm, it needs to be routinely examined in coroner's courts and recorded on records of inquest and the medical cause of death.
Well, I think that pretty much wraps it up. Thank you both very much, Mary and Dan, for allowing us to survey this rather gloomy landscape. I must say, if I had my say, having done the research for this programme, I'm completely shocked by the number of gambling ads that come up in every series or film that you watch, and I'd ban that. But of course, obviously the industry doesn't want it and governments don't see any reason to do that. But it's a drug. It's a drug. Anyway, thank you both of you for coming on LawPod UK to discuss this problem.
Thank you very much.
Thank you for having us.